secondary opportunities for students. We all know each other at the table, so we'll dispense with that part. We'll go right to the agenda and ask Assistant Commissioner Klintzing to give us an overview on the subject of post-secondary opportunities, and whether it be an advanced placement, PSEO. We're going to also hear about IB, college enrollment within schools. And I'm particularly interested, too, in the cost benefit for each. And we've had a lot of testimony in tours that we've had at school districts. And so we'll get the overview and then look forward to individual testifiers as well. Welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to that you are taking a look as a joint committee at this, because I think one of the biggest or most exciting things about dual credit, as well as one of the bigger challenges, is the articulation from the from the high schools over into the college. It is an exciting opportunity for students, but tricky sometimes to make that bridge for them between the two different institutions. They operate very differently. I had the opportunity yesterday to be in Marshall, Minnesota, where we were talking to students about science, technology, engineering, and math careers, and also about college, what helps them be ready for college in terms of those careers, where we see a 20 to 30% increase in Minnesota alone. Those are the predictions for those occupations. And the students were very, very interested, on the edge of their seat, about what they need to do in order to be ready for the post-secondary training that most of these jobs are going to require, whether it be 1 year, 2 year, 4 year, or a 6 year degree that they need to get. So I'm going to go through a little bit of a PowerPoint here that shows you the six different areas that we've identified as opportunities for students to get that dual credit in high school and college at the same time. Some of these are on campus, some of these are not on campus. There's all sorts of different ways that students can access dual credit.
And excuse me,
yeah.
We have a lot of handouts at the table, but I think the two main ones that you will refer to would be this one with an overhead, and then you have a brochure. Would that be
correct? Yeah, we have the PowerPoint slides for you right here. So if we go too quickly, you can refer back to those. And then there's the pink brochure here that goes is really a brochure that we're making available to schools.
Oh, okay. So two exhibits for your reference. Please proceed.
Dual credit is really an opportunity for qualified high school students to enroll in and earn credit for college-level coursework. It's a tool for aligning and integrating high school and post-secondary education so that those expectations are the same. And it's an opportunity for students to practice college-level work while supported by collaborating high school and college instructors. One of the biggest misconceptions that students have about college is that the hard part is getting in. Really, the hard part about post-secondary is making it through. It's that success rate in ending their degree successfully. And one of the things that prepares the students for getting through post-secondary program successfully is rigorous work in high school, rigorous coursework. Dual credit's important because it increases the number of historically underserved students who are ready for college. And you're going to see how some of our numbers glean that out. Some of the success from 05 to 06 show you that we are getting students who weren't typically on this track into a track that's post-secondary ready. It improves motivation through high expectations and the promise of free credits or college-level courses. Promotes institutional relationships between the post-secondary institutions and high schools. We talked to a lot of faculty on both sides of the bridge who really enjoy working with each other to align expectations. And increases enrollment, participation, and retention in post-secondary educational opportunities. And we do have some studies that show that rigorous coursework for students in high school really does correlate with their success in post-secondary programs afterwards. These are the six different pathways we've identified for students to get dual credit. Advanced placement is one of those. International baccalaureate programs, college level examination placement exams, which is a new one here in Minnesota, concurrent enrollment, which you're going to hear from some of these today, post-secondary enrollment options. We have been a trailblazer, the state has, in this area of dual credit for students in high school, and we started it with post-secondary enrollment options back in 1986. And some of you may have been on that trailblazing or made that trailblazing vote.
Well, a few of us are old enough, Mr. Chairman, to have been here. No, not you.
Okay, please proceed.
So we appreciate that. And career and technical education is one of those pathways that some folks don't always think of as an opportunity for dual credit, but actually is one of the areas or the pathways that has one of the strongest relationships with or for articulation across the high school and college bridge there. The advanced placement program, we probably know a lot about, but just want to go through some of the key components of the program. It involves 35 college-level courses with exams in 19 general areas. The examinations are graded against national standards, so the students take the same test in Minnesota as they do in Massachusetts, as they do in Louisiana. It has an extensive system of teacher professional development and resources, so you do have to be trained by the College Board to teach the AP classes. The students successfully complete AP exams. If they do that, they can earn college credit and or advanced standing at most colleges and universities. They do need to get a 3 or higher at most colleges or universities. There are some that require a 4 or higher on the exam, and that's, of course, out of 5. Students can earn awards, scholarships, and improve chances of college admission. The current status in 2007 here is that we have 235 public schools who are testing students for AP. 273 teachers received in-depth training. And you can see that we have 22,929 test takers, and that's up 16.9% from 2006. And the year before, we had seen a similar increase from 05 to 06. So this has been a steady increase and is beating the national average.
A question. How many possible schools? You said 235 currently. What would be the universe approximately?
Well, we have 300 and some districts. I don't know the total number of schools.
Yeah, 338, but that's schools or school districts?
This is public schools, high schools.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Pappas.
I didn't want to interrupt you.
No,
okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Klinzing, was that the number of teachers who received the training in 2007 only, not the total number of teachers who received the training?
Correct.
Senator Thompson.
Chairman, Ms. Klinzing, earlier you said that everybody takes the same test nationwide. Do they compare states in these tests?
They do.
And how do we do? Is that coming up?
Let's see. We do have extensive information on that, but we were limited to 15 minutes, so I didn't, but I can provide you that information if you would
like
it.
Are we number one, number five, number, you know?
We tend to rank... Stuart, do you have that information?
Nationally,
you working for
I'm
these guys
I'm going to bring now? Stuart up here. Stuart Lottie is our new advanced placement.
He's a good one.
Other concurrent enrollment program specialist.
Hello, Senator Thomastoni. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Welcome aboard.
Well, thank you. Nationally,
please state your name for the recording.
I'm sorry, Stuart Lottie. I'm the AP state coordinator. Nationally, the average test score is of all the states is about 58%, 3 and above pass rate. In Minnesota, this year did the Lake Wobegon number and it was about 62%, 3 and above. So we hope to do better on that. We have come up every year, and we have some statistics on that. Karen, do you have that in front of you there?
In terms of our increase. We do have an increase this year in the number of, well, this is exams taken. Sorry. In 2007, the percentage of students earning a 3 or higher on an AP exam was 13.4%, and nationally is 15.2%.
Senator Sherman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I was curious about this number also, about the number of public schools that are involved in the advanced placement program, and I'm simply wondering, what is there a target goal for that, or are you able to, without using too much of your 15-minute time, to say why aren't there more schools involved than 235?
We have, as you'll see today, there are six different ways that programs that schools really can take on in order to provide students dual credit opportunities. And some have chosen, said that advanced placement just isn't for them. And they've chosen International Baccalaureate. Some have chosen College in the Schools. And there's various reasons for that. Sometimes it has to do with having enough students or teachers who are trained at the school, having the opportunity to send the teachers to be trained, having the interest of the teachers who want to go to the training and the availability in the summer to do it. There's just various reasons why schools may or may not choose to do this particular route. There's another school I'm going to mention later, Byron. They've really taken on this college-level examination placement exam as the program that fits their school the best, and they've really seen a surge in the number of students taking those kinds of exams.
Mr. Chair. May I follow up one
yes.
question?
Okay.
At some point, then, perhaps what I would be interested in is knowing how many schools overall are participating in these kind of dual programs so that I'm understanding better overall. They may not choose one or the other. They may choose one or another program, but how are we impacting the whole system in terms of this opportunity throughout the state?
Yeah, that's a good question. And a number of places actually do more than one of these. So you'll see advanced placement and College in the Schools and PSEO and CTE, which are four of the programs here that are being offered by just one district.
But we would like to get that for all Minnesota students. What is the opportunity at each school? Admittedly, it's limited at others, but we'd like to get the map on that. And also, and maybe you'll have a chance to touch on it, the cost per student, and as we make budget decisions as to where we get the best yield for our limited dollar. Senator Thomasoni, and then we'll let you
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Lotti, one more little follow-up on my question. 58% was the nationwide average. 62% is Minnesota's average. What's the best state's average?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thomasoni, that's a very good question. Assistant Commissioner Klinzing and I have talked about that, and we feel that Massachusetts is a state that we really would like to emulate. They are running at about 70%, 3 and above right now. We have looked at similar socioeconomic states. For example, Washington State, which we believe has a similar socioeconomic basis, is Minnesota. They give about the same number of exams, and their 3 and above is even about the same as ours, about 62%. Wisconsin is, we now give more exams in Wisconsin, about 4,000 more exams. We just passed them. But for a number of years, Wisconsin's 3 and above rate had been running as much as 10% better than ours, and we're narrowing the gap on them. I think they're about 5% better than we are, 3 and above. In a related comment here, going to Senator Sherman's question, in terms of growth, in 02-03, Minnesota gave 22,000 AP exams, and 06-07, we gave 36,000 AP exams. So we're experiencing a growth rate of 15% to 20% a year, and we want to continue doing that. And the help of the legislature in terms of the appropriations is a big cause for this growth. I need to add that.
Okay. Thank you. And Ms. Klingsing, if you could, in about 10 minutes, highlight the others. We'll refrain from questions until we've had additional testifiers, but we obviously have more to talk about.
Students who take no AP courses have a 29% chance of completing a bachelor's degree in 4 years or less. Students who take one AP course, the probability increases to 45%. And students who take two or more AP courses, the likelihood increases to 61%. And even with the increase in participation this year, we still saw an increase in our scores as well, a significant increase. So this is a good indication that opening these up to more students really is what the students need and are looking for.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, that statistic is related just to taking the course, not necessarily even having passed the exam?
That's correct. So you could get a one or two and not even get the college credit out of it and still realize this effect. 1,140 low-income students took 1,620 exams, which we fully reimburse thanks to the funding that you provided. 4,114 students of color. This increase in minority test takers from 2006 to 2007 for Hispanics was 36.9%, and for our black population was 45.6% this past year. Key aspects of the program for international baccalaureate is that it has three programs, the primary years, middle years, and the diploma. The diploma program, comprehensive two-year international curriculum for students, is for ages 16 to 19 and offers 157 exams in 51 different disciplines. This is more of a comprehensive program that a school would need to take on. It becomes an integral part of the entire curriculum that the student is involved in. Students in full diploma program are required to study and take exams in six different academic subjects, and they will then qualify for college-level credit. The current status of this for 2007, and you're going to hear more on this because I just ran into Conrad Anderson here, who's here from South St. Paul, and he really knows a lot about this. But 22 authorized IB schools in Minnesota. 12 of the schools are doing the testing at this point. 78 teachers have attended in-depth training, and 214 IB courses are offered by 231 teachers. This is a slightly newer program to Minnesota. That's probably why you don't see quite as high of number of participation, plus it involves an entire school taking it on, and so that is a huge undertaking for a school, more than just taking on one AP course. Number of participating students has gone up 14% since 2006, and the number of exams taken has gone up 20%. This is a national impact study on IB. Various studies have been conducted on how IB actually affects students and the standards of the IB program, the effect that the implementation of the program has on a school. IB students outperform their peers on state assessments. IB standards are aligned with best practice in education and support effective teaching practices. Has a positive impact on the culture of the school. They have a higher acceptance rates to colleges, and IB diploma students perform better in post-secondary education than their peers. In Minnesota, 361 low-income students took 753 exams. Students of color in the diploma program include 481. The average number of exams per diploma program student is 2.3. and they've earned 129 diplomas. The percent of scores, 4+, which is equivalent to the kind of the 3+ and up in AP, is 67%, and for diploma students is 79%. Post-secondary education, post-secondary enrollment options promotes rigorous coursework by enabling high school students to enroll full or part-time ineligible post-secondary institutions. It's open to grades 11 and 12 for students who meet the admissions requirements of the post-secondary institution. They do not pay for the tuition, fees, or books that comes out of the funds of the school that they're coming from, the high school. Students earn high school credit courses, and if they continue their education, colleges or universities may choose to transfer their completed coursework through PSEO as college credits. And Minnesota was the first state to offer this option, as we mentioned before, because it was enacted in 1985. That's in 86, my apologies. The other thing to mention about this is an on-campus experience for students. They leave their high school campus and go on to the college campus. This is different from the first two that we just talked about, where they stay in their resident high schools. The current status of this is that in 05-06, we had 7,416 participants. In 06-07, 7,564. Students in full-time PSEO, 2,197, and this year, 2,296. This has been a fairly consistent. It hasn't dropped nor significantly increased much in the last 4 or 5 years. It's been fairly stable. Participation has been steady over the past 5 years. 5.5% of the eligible population has participated in the average of 16.5 credits taken per participating students in 2006-2007. And this can be a significant undertaking for parents because they end up, you know, oftentimes providing transport for the kids, and the schedules don't always work out as well. And that's why you might not see, there may be a kind of a glass ceiling, shall we say, on how many students would want to get involved in this option. For concurrent enrollment, you're going to hear about the real experts here today.
Excuse
yes.
me. Senator Sherman.
On this program, is the school that accepts the students on their campus to take these courses may transfer these credits or allow for them in their college credit? Is it only the system that accepts them to take those courses, or is it throughout the university system? Is include Minnesota, if they take these courses at Minnesota State Mankato, can they apply those courses at the University of Minnesota or Normandale?
Essentially, they end up with a college transcript, and so they would have to go through the same sort of
so, but it could be any,
yeah,
any.
They could system. Get it transferred okay. to another institution.
Mm-hmm. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, do you have comparable statistics here? For example, on the AP and IB, you had the kids who took those courses did better in college or were more likely to graduate. Do you have any kind of statistics like that on the PSEO students?
Ms. Glensing.
Yes. I am not recalling any particular study just on PSEO, but I will say that the studies I've seen nationally on students' participation in any sort of college-level class is consistent in that and consistent with what you saw for AP and IB.
Thanks. We'll go to concurrent enrollment.
And again, there are two experts sitting here that are going to talk to you today about it, so I'll just breeze through some of the general aspects of the program. This is a high school-college collaboration where the courses are taught in the high school to juniors and seniors. But the difference between this and, say, AP or IB is that the colleges have established criteria for the high school instructor that need to be met for them to be considered qualified to teach these college-level courses in the high schools. In that respect, it's a little bit like AP because the AP has the College Board training the instructors similarly as well. It differs from the one college to the next sometimes as to what those qualifications need to be. But there's an agreement worked out between the high school and the college. It's an opportunity, again, for students to earn both high school and college credit at the same time and provides participating teachers with ongoing college-based, discipline-specific professional development. So really the teachers get some professional development out of this at the same time. There was brand new legislation, $150 per pupil enrolled, to use to defray the cost of delivering these courses that was passed and appropriated by you folks last year. By 2011, the funding is only for credited courses through NASEP. Minnesota Department of Education is projecting as many as 44,000 requests for $2.5 million allocation this year.
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Pappas.
Ms. Klinzing, so is college and the schools the same thing as concurrent enrollment?
Concurrent enrollment is a general term to refer to any sort of, so there are some career and technical education courses that have worked out concurrent enrollment opportunities. But College in the Schools is a specific program that falls under that general term of concurrent enrollment. It's a good question. There's a lot of dual credit, dual enrollment. What does all this mean? So, the key aspects, the next one that, because you're going to hear about the experts on concurrent enrollment a little bit, but college level examination placement exam is another new program we have for dual credit for students. It's a rigorous college board program that allows students to demonstrate knowledge of college level material. 34 CLEP exams are available that test the mastery of college level material learned through a variety of means, general academic instruction, significant independent study, or extracurricular work. The difference between this and some of the other programs we just looked at is that the teacher, there is no real course necessarily associated with the college-level examination placement exam. The student goes to a testing center, much like they would go to an ACT or SAT testing center. After they, after the school has determined that the student probably has done enough studying to meet the or to take the test and be successful in the test and then help the student get to the testing site and take the test there. And it is the same test across the nation. So it's not different from one state to the other or from one school to the other or from one district to the other. So you could have, and I think this is why some of the more outstate schools have kind of looked at this as an opportunity for them. You could have 9 or 10 kids who can't make up an entire course but who could maybe make up a part of an English course, who could then do some extra studying or take a study hall together or be tutored separately or just study on their own at home to be ready for the college-level placement exam in English or whatever the other 33 subject areas are that they want to study for. If you've got a student, one student at the school who wants to do a business CLEP exam, then that one student could get prepared for this. So this is kind of nice for those places that don't have enough kids for a whole course. It's a cost-effective means, too, of earning college credit and would go on. You do have to pick one school to send, like one college to send the credit to. So then once you start a transcript at that college, you would, if you wanted to use that credit at a different college, you'd have to transfer the credit, much like you do for PSEO. This is the number of students testing in 05-06. It was brand new. The money had just been appropriated, and we were still trying to get the schools knowledgeable about the program and what it meant. It's exponentially increased to this year, and we expect a further explosion in the following year as more schools become familiar with what this is. We have the percent of students getting 50 or plus for college credit was 67% last year, went down just a little bit as we increased participation significantly. And then it shows you the percent taken by white students, the percent by ethnic minority students would was too insignificant. The number was insignificant, so we couldn't make any statistically significant correlations in terms of achievement. The CLEP students have a higher cumulative GPA than students who did not take the CLEP. Students who earn credit via CLEP perform as well or better in subsequent courses than students who completed the equivalent course. And CLEP students earn about half a grade point higher than students in the equivalent course. Another one is career and technical education programs, which have been around forever. Some may know of them as vocational courses, and you're, again, you've got another expert in the audience who's going to come in, and we go to her oftentimes to get our answers, Deb Belfry. But just to let you know that we're really thinking of career and technical education at the department as another way for students to earn dual credit, because there are so many programs within career and technical education that do provide students that dual credit option and provide them a lot of concurrent enrollment programs exist through this, and I'll give you one example that comes immediately to mind, and that's nursing assistant. Students can actually work with a college or university to get a nursing assistant degree, and I ran into one student at STEP in Anoka which is a high school dedicated career in technical education, that the student got her nursing assistant certificate and then went on to work her way through college because she was able to work as a nursing assistant mm-hmm. and then make the money to become a nurse. So this is just really an excellent avenue for those students who really are more in the applied areas, but there's a lot of opportunities in the applied areas to get that post-secondary credit at the same time as you're going through high school. We are looking at, we're being required actually by the federal government to reauthorize our Perkins plan, and there's some changes that they're requiring of our state. And here's a little summary of what those changes are going to look like. A single local plan is going to have to be developed in 26 regions throughout the state governing secondary and post-secondary programming and expenditures. So there's going to be consortiums that are located around the state that are working, where the high schools in that consortium and the colleges in that consortium are working together. This is to provide better articulation and transfer of credit for students. The local plans must include secondary to post-secondary transitions through articulation agreements, concurrent enrollment, and PSEO. And there will be programs of study developed to identify both technical and academic courses beginning no later than grade 11 and continuing for at least 2 years beyond high school. These programs of study are not rigid, like if you need to decide you're going to be a nurse and here's how you do it. What it is a, it's more like a roadmap for students who might be looking in the medical careers to help them understand, if I do want to be an x-ray technician, what would that pathway look like? But then also have jumping off points for them to say along the way, boy, this isn't kind of what I like. I'm going to jump over here into detective work or over into becoming a nurse or a doctor or a physician. So the idea is to provide a roadmap, but make it flexible and provide lots of opportunities for students to jump in and out of that program of study to provide some articulation for students grades 11 through 14.
Mr. Chair?
Sarah Wilbling.
Thank you. Ms. Klensing, how come we're doing 26 regions throughout the state? I'm trying to, you know, envision that some of these students aren't going to stay in that region, of course. And so we're concerned more about the high school to the post-secondary, but the post-secondary throughout our state is pretty much the same. So I'm just trying to understand that.
Right. The regions were, or the consortiums were formed to really provide more efficient administrative structures for the areas and more clear articulation of credit, so that what was I think happening before as a student, there wasn't anybody watching within a region over a student enough to know that when they got done, when they were ready to graduate from high school, they had a couple credits at this college, a couple credits over here, and a couple credits over here, and they didn't really come together to help that student move forward or advance towards a particular degree, so that there was lacking alignment. And I think that this particular plan or region consortium design has come about as a result of wanting to try to help areas work together for the students' benefit, so that they were going to get through a more aligned and articulated program that articulated very specifically to a particular college. But the student is not confined to the region. They can move over lines. It's more an administrative region. So the student probably won't even know the region exists.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Romley.
So if they have college in the schools and those credits, like Shakopee has the University of Minnesota partnering with them and they bring courses in, Belle Plaine has Mankato State. So are those credits transferable? Could the students in Belle Plaine who got the credits from the Mankato transfer them to the University of Minnesota if they want to go there, and vice versa?
They can.
Okay. Please proceed. And if you could summarize in the next 3 minutes.
Many local and some regional articulation agreements are in place governing credit transfer from secondary to post-secondary CTE. The new structure has been identified to guide planning and programming, and the programs of study are currently being developed. Minnesota's secondary post-secondary CTE consortium model is unique in the nation and being looked at as a model collaboration. Joint secondary, post-secondary development of local plans will align the programming from high schools to colleges and expand our belief is it's going to expand opportunities for students. We have raised academic achievement advanced placement program grants, and just want to quickly point out that there are some schools that got some very specific grants that were funded by this body. 21 grants were awarded, and the whole they were awarded based on programs that are trying to increase participation and achievement at the same time, especially for students who have typically not been engaged in dual credit opportunities. There have been $6 million that's gone over this into a two-year period ending on June 30th, 2009. So measurable objectives are going to be used, and you're going to get feedback on what happens in those programs and whether they really do meet those objectives and goals and how that funding affected the students' pathways. And there were six grants. The grant goal to establish a new or expand an existing program was designed, as I said earlier, to increase availability and access, expand the breadth of courses available, and increase the number of and diversity of participating students. So that is it. If we know there's a lot more to this and a lot of statistics behind it, so if you ever need anything more answered, I'm going to get you the one question about the total number of schools who have a program. We're probably going to have to take some time to map that out because there's a lot of different programs here, but we definitely think that's worth, I mean, I think it's a great question, and then we'll try to see what we can do about the cost per student for you.
Okay. Thank you for the overview, and that would be very helpful to get that for each district and high schools, and with the offerings and some cost information, and if you have any comparative analysis, that would be helpful. We know you'll be here. Sandra Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Glinzing, one quick question. You talked about the grants for the AP, and it seems to me that as we visited a number of school districts during the interim, we often received comment that that schools would, in fact, be interested in increasing their AP opportunities, but often was cited that it was due to financial constraints that they didn't. So do districts apply for these grants, and do you feel that there are adequate resources there for districts that are interested in expanding their AP offerings?
Quincy.
We had a significant number of applicants that we could not award due to limited resources. So the demand is definitely there for a number of excellent proposals, but we could only fund so many given the money that we had available.
That might be helpful to have an annotation of that in the report for districts
That's
that
fine.
Were not approved that had stated a need. That'll be worthy. Yeah, Senator Shern.
And in that report, maybe how did you determine which of the applications rose to the top? What was your criteria, and what were you targeting more than something else in terms of those applications that helped you define the award?
The RFP asked for the schools to show that they were going to do something to increase the number of students who participated in the program or increase the courses available. So the biggest criteria was, are they going to increase participation? And then at the same time, does their plan seem to have the pieces in place to ensure that as they increase that participation, that those students will also, or that school will be able to kind of maintain the success rate of the achievement? So not just open up a new course, but also provide the teacher the training they need to open up the new course and provide the students. In a lot of cases, in a few cases, I know we awarded grants to schools that put AVID in place. And AVID is a college access program to help students who typically wouldn't be thinking about college, to give them the skills early on in elementary and middle school, both habits of the mind as well as the study skills, to prepare them to take part in more rigorous coursework. So so that was another piece that was looked at, not just opening up opportunity for students and participation, but also the criteria of, are you putting the supports in place to ensure success for students and teachers?
Thank you. We'll go next to advanced placement, Principal George Johnson, Pine City. And members, for pacing this, we'll probably go about 12 to 15 minutes on this portion. Item 3, about 20 minutes, 15 or so minutes for each of the final items, 4 and 5. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm George Johnson, principal at Pine City High School. I've worked at that high school for 32 years now. I've been a principal for 22 years, a high school principal for 10 years, and I wanted to give you a little bit of picture of what options a small rural Minnesota school provides for students to pick up college credits.
Members, we have one handout.
I have one handout. Okay. It's called Options for College Credit at Pine City High School.
Thank you.
Pine City has approximately 800 students in grades 7 through 12. Each graduating class right now is averaging around 140 students. We've had our advanced placement program for 22 years. We focus in on increasing enrollment on AP courses, and we encourage all students to take our advanced placement courses, even though they may not earn college credits for it. It's a belief in our school that the kids are going to benefit by taking more rigorous courses. And so if they don't get a score on the test high enough to achieve college credit, we still feel that they've gained significantly. So in most cases, we do not restrict enrollment in our advanced placement courses. You can see under A, the enrollment for 2008 and 2009. And what I did was show you how many students registered in 2008. We generally register in January of the previous year. So in January, we had 24 students register for advanced placement lit. Right now, we have 15 students in that class. So there is attrition in some of these classes and not in others. So you can see the courses we offer in AP Lit, European History, Psychology, Calculus, and you can see the number we have in those classes this year, and you can see the number that have registered in January of this year for 2008-2009. We did add one course, U.S. History. We have 32 students who registered for that course, and we hope to add that next year. I will say, however, if you look at those numbers in AP literature, you'll see we have 49 students who registered. The interesting point about that is we have three options for seniors. Basically, they can take a college-level course through a local college called Communications. They can take this AP course, or they can take something called College Honors, which does not give them college credit. The College Honors course is actually the most rigorous of the three courses, and the students have chosen to take the AP course, which ironically is less rigorous than the Honors course. But that will give them an opportunity to get credit if they can score high enough on the test. Senior class of 2008 had 141 students, 31 seniors, or 22% of them, take at least one AP course. Our junior class in 2009 has 137 students. 66 seniors, or 48% of them, signed up to take at least one advanced placement course. You had some interest in test results. Our test results for 2007 were the best that we have ever had. The average score was a 3. Going back from 2006-2002, I listed for you the percentages of the number of students who have scored 3, 4, or 5. And this year, the score was 62% of the students who scored at that level. So we had a significant increase in the number of students who are going to qualify for college credit through those advanced placement classes. And we had increased scores in every subject area. I did list for you also the scores from 2007, 2006, 2005 in those courses we offer and the percents at each level.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Thomson.
Mr. Chairman, do you know why?
Why the scores increased?
Mm-hmm.
It's a good question. I think that it's a combination of an emphasis on the problems with grade inflation and sharing that information as well as information on rigor in the classroom with parents and students and teachers. And the rigor in our classrooms has increased. Our grade point averages have actually decreased, which I think is a good thing because our grades were inflated, as most grades across Minnesota are in high schools, I think. The average grade in schools in our area right now is a B, between a B minus and a B plus. And ours is now, since we put the emphasis on the rigor and more appropriate grading, has dropped down to a C plus. We also have weighted grades for advanced or honors courses, and that's increased the enrollment in those courses also.
Mm-hmm. Please proceed.
State reimbursement for exams, I show for you that we were reimbursed totally for 33 exams at $75 per exam last year. The previous year, we were reimbursed about $60 per exam. Previous to that, the reimbursement ranged from zero to a percentage. And in our school, we basically covered the cost of those exams for the students. Number of area schools charged or had the students pay the fee for the test. We chose to absorb that fee in our budget as a reward for these kids taking more advanced courses. The next page shows you some current options for college credit. We have three of them listed for you here. We have three credits that are articulated with Pine Technical College, a college that happens to be in the same town as our high school. In these articulated courses, they're taught by one of our teachers in the high school. There's no cost to the high school, which, of course, we approve and enjoy. The courses meet the required transfer curriculum and will transcript at Pine Tech College. And you've asked questions about grades transcripting to other schools. What we have found, you know, Pine Tech College will tell us and told me on the phone that these grades will transcript to any college. We have had students come back and express differences as to whether or not the grades would transfer. Some of them transferred across the board. Some transferred only as electives. For example, the accounting course, some of the students said their accounting course would not transfer as an accounting course, but rather as an elective. And some said that the schools wouldn't accept the articulate course at all. So we see some variance on that in terms of who will accept those articulate courses. And we show you the numbers of students who are enrolled in the courses, two of them this year and then one next year. We have scheduled to go. It's child development is an every other year course. We belong to a cable cooperative established somewhere around 1980, I think. This is a cooperative of somewhere between 11 and 16 schools, depending on what the particular area of cooperation is. These college courses are offered over cable TV in our school. The students are taught at Pine City High School. The instructor comes to them over video from Pine Technical College. We pay $330 per college semester course for those courses versus our normal fee of $250 for a high school cable course. And you can see the courses that we offer and the ones that the students are taking basically deal with students getting into the field of nursing or medical fields. We also offer courses through Lake Superior College in an agreement with them. These are online courses. The students access the class from computers at our school. So this allows them to have a full schedule at Pine City High School, and part of their schedule could mean they're taking a college course on cable from Pi Technical College. They could be taking a college course from Lake Superior College online right in the school there. The sample cost for one student taking a comp class was $502 in tuition, and then Pine City pays for the books there also. And you can see the students that we have enrolled in those courses through Lake Superior.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Wouldn't it be possible for them to take those online courses through any of the, like, the Minsku schools? Or do you just have a special arrangement with Lake Superior? Because all of our schools do offer online courses. So could they sign up for any of them, or how does it work, just through Lake Superior?
We contract directly with Lake Superior College, and we contract directly with Pine Technical College, and we offer those courses. We aren't able to offer online courses to other colleges unless we establish an agreement with them. And there is a lot of competition among the colleges to establish agreements with high schools, and that I can talk about a little bit on the next page.
Okay. Thank you.
Our potential on enrollment options for next year, there is an online school that's been formed as a part of our education consortium, cooperating with another consortium called MinCola. MinCola provides and hires their own teachers. They charge $400 per course currently. The high schools, one of the additional costs we have is that we must provide a mentor for those students. The course is offered right out of our high school. They currently offer 34 courses total, four of which are available for college credit. We anticipate that will be increasing, and we also anticipate that MinCola will follow through and the price will drop down to around $330 per course in the next year or half. Year and a half, as they have promised they would. As far as concurrent enrollment options, in this you saw the high schools provide the teacher and the colleges provide a mentor. These teachers have to meet certain requirements. There's a draft that has come out recently to unify the requirements for Minsku colleges. If that's passed, the requirement would be that the teacher would have to have a master's degree in the content area or 16 master's credit in the content area. And there isn't a way to get a variance on that. Basically, the cost is negotiable between $1,500 and $3,000 per course. We're currently in conversations with Pine Tech discussing three different classes that we would offer in the future. We have participated in the St. Cloud State University program called Seniors to Sophomore. When we initially signed up probably 8 years ago, the cost was $2,000 per course. Now the cost is $3,000 for up to 30 students. And then there's additional costs if you have more than 30 students. C&D is just an example of one of the area schools that's negotiating with colleges for costs. At Southwest State, they were given a price of $3,000 for a course, but they have a ceiling on their pricing. So if you have enough students, the cost is cheaper per student. For example, they have four sections of college algebra, and there's a cap on what Southwest State would charge them for college algebra, so they can offer that course to four sections of it for $3,000 or $5,000. They work with Anoka Ramsey, the community campus or Cambridge campus, and they charge $2,500 for each section. So they would have to pay $10,000 for those four sections of college prep. So it gives you an idea of why we're negotiating with different colleges to try to offer the best packages at the best price that we can.
That's interesting.
Thank you. Questions? Your recommendations?
I did have a question.
You get to make the rules at your school. If you could make the rules for these dual choices, what would you do?
I would like to have some uniformity in the options that we have. And, you know, ideally, I think these students are best served, the majority of them, best served in the high schools using either these online courses or articulated courses and still getting to be a part of the high school experience. That's what I'd like to see happen, and I'd like to see it happen more with the articulation options. I gave you an example of the college comp, advanced placement literature, honors college course that we offer, the three options kids have, because that college, that honors college prep language arts course, which they can't get credit for, has more rigor in it than the other two courses. And I say that as I'm an old English teacher, and I've taught the college
experienced
prep courses for years, and I've looked at the college class and its curriculum and seen some of the work the students have done, spent a lot of time observing the AP course, and I think that the kids who are taking the most rigorous classes should be getting college credit for it. And somehow we have to make the system uniform so that that can happen. If they're taking a rigorous college-level course, no matter who's offering to it, I think that they should be able to get credit for college credit for it.
Senator Pappas, followed by Senator Robley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Principal Johnson. Are you seeing any change in behavior due to high tuition? Are students becoming and their parents becoming more cost-conscious and wanting to get college credit while they're in high school in order to lessen their college tuition costs?
Most definitely. And that's why I think articulation would be a good step, because we could actually limit the number of students who are leaving 4 years of college with $60,000 in debt if we can get them the rigor and the classes that they need in high school. And that's our job as high schools, to increase the rigor. And it's not a popular thing with parents when the students start coming home with lower GPAs and start having to work harder. That's probably the biggest obstacle we've faced with increasing rigor in our courses.
Wow. Mr. Chairman, one more question.
Senator Pappas.
Would it be helpful for you if, I don't know how often you hire new teachers, but there's a lot of cost involved in training teachers to be able to teach rigorous courses, AP or IB or college in the schools or whatever. Would it be more helpful if new teachers had that training already when they were in teacher training school?
If they're new teachers fresh out of college 4 years, I don't think so. But the experienced teachers, who are the ones we would put into advanced classes in most cases, it does benefit them from having the advanced training. We send all of our advanced placement teachers to training ourselves, and the state's been very good about helping us to pay for those.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, Mr. Johnson, you're saying it's not that useful for new teachers to have the rigorous teaching training. It's more helpful if experienced teachers do it.
Well, the new teachers can use the training to increase rigor in the classrooms, but I'd be more apt to put a veteran teacher in an advanced placement or an honors course than a new teacher, unless, you know, we hired a new teacher once who had a doctorate in biology, and that was an exception to the rule. She went right into teaching honors courses, mm-hmm. but generally the ones who teach the honors courses have teaching experience already.
But the advantage of having a new teacher having that training is she could or he could bring that rigor to whatever class they were teaching.
Right, and the preparation classes for the honors classes.
Okay.
One more question, Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I was wondering about the honor courses. If those students wanted to take the test for the advanced placement, would they be permitted to? Because if it truly is more rigorous, their chance of perhaps scoring a 3 or above might be pretty good. Would they be permitted to do that?
They would be permitted, but when the AP teachers teach their course, they gear it toward what the expectations test. Are for that advanced placement test. And when the college preparatory language arts teachers teach, they gear what they teach toward what they think the colleges are looking for in terms of students being able to write well. And I don't know if the two mesh well enough for the kids to do well in the AP test.
Mr. Chair, it would be interesting to do a little test project or pilot project and have some of those honors courses students take the AP test and see how they fare on the scoring. That would be really interesting if you could talk some of them into taking it. Because they could get the credit if they pass it potentially.
Thank you very much, Principal Johnson, for your perspective. And if I could ask also on the suggestion that you made on or the question you posed, why would a student taking the most rigorous path of all in an honors course, why can't they get credit? And perhaps the Department of Education, Ms. Klinsing, or someone could follow up, and I would ask with their recommendation as to how that could be done. Because, as you said, that is very ironic. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Ask the PSEO concurrent enrollment testifiers, the three, to join us for the next segment. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Senator Pappas and senators. I'm Susan Henderson. I'm director of the pre-college programs in the College of Continuing Education at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. So I work with both the concurrent enrollment program called College in the Schools, and I work with the PSEO program. I did bring materials, and I think you have a lot of them. Perhaps the best, a really good one, is the annual report. Programs for high school students and teachers. That looks like this.
Okay.
I'd also like to draw your attention to a blue sheet that is entitled Concurrent Enrollment in Minnesota. It's a 2006-07 fact sheet.
Okay. Thanks for pointing those out.
Right. Okay. College in the Schools at the University of Minnesota and PSEO at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus have been around for 20-plus years. So that seems like a long time, but we have not been around as long as advanced placement courses. So we find that more people understand how AP courses work than understand how concurrent enrollment courses work. Most people understand PSEO. I should also clarify that I work with the Twin Cities program. Each of our campuses run their pre-college program separately and somewhat differently, although we do talk with each other. So I have the most authoritative information about the Twin Cities campus programs than the others. But first, I want you to look at the blue sheet. For the last, I would say, 4 years, the administrators of concurrent enrollment programs in Minnesota have come together twice a year to share best practices, to identify common areas of interest and concern. Part of our work together is to conduct a survey. We have not been regular in that survey, but I think we will be now. The blue sheet reports the findings from a survey we conducted this fall. So you can see that 16,684 unduplicated students, one student, have taken concurrent enrollment courses in Minnesota. And we've had 27,824 course registrations. So you can see a lot of students take more than one course. We have 384 partner high schools. And I do want to add that there is duplication in that count because we know that many of our partners partner with more than one higher ed institution. So we don't have that sorted out yet. And we also know that 1,056 high school teachers who are approved to teach college courses, that's a duplicated number as well. We know that some of our teachers teach courses for different concurrent enrollment programs, different secondary or post-secondary institutions. So the materials that I have really highlight or give you comprehensive information, and I will highlight some of that information. There are two white sheets that are charts. They're called University of Minnesota On-Campus PSEO Programs. One is for Morris and Crookston. One is for Twin Cities and Duluth campuses. We emailed and called all the rest of the campuses to gather this information so we could get it all together for you. And we have the contact information, too, if you'd like to talk with them directly. You can see that the University of Minnesota PSEO program serves really high-achieving students. And you can look at that under the student qualification requirements. So you'll see that both Crookston and UMD, oh, I'm wrong. There's some places have 3.0, that's Crookston, and UMD has 3.5 high school GPA required to be admitted. The Twin Cities campus, we don't have a minimum GPA, but we review the applications holistically, and we find that the average GPA is about 3.8. So these are super students. We monitor their progress closely so that students... We use the midterm alerts that come out from the university alerting students if they're not doing well. We also have contact with our faculty. We monitor their GPAs at the end of a term, and if they're not up to our minimum requirement, at least on the Twin Cities campus, we ask them to either drop the number of credits they're taking, and in some cases, they are dismissed from the program. So those two sheets will give you a quick overview of how PSEO runs at the University of Minnesota. Oh, I want to emphasize also that you'll see there is advising. Students cannot register for a University of Minnesota course on any of the campuses unless they meet and talk with an advisor and the advisor approves the course selection. The courses are academic, hardcore academic. You can see in the pre-college on this report, this annual report just for the Twin Cities, you can see some of the courses that students take. I would like to then turn your attention to the gold sheet that is, again, University of Minnesota concurrent enrollment programs. And you'll see right away that only three of the campuses offer that. Morris is not participating. The Twin Cities campus is by far the largest program. Last year, we served 3,754 unduplicated students. But Crookston's right up there. They served 1,243 unduplicated students. Again, you'll see the admission requirements for students varies a bit from place to place, as well as the requirements for teachers to teach. Crookston is similar to Minsky in that it requires a master's degree in the discipline or a bachelor's plus 18 hours of graduate credit in the discipline. Again, the Twin Cities program reviews applications holistically. It's not that we don't care about quality, but we address quality not by looking at credentials necessarily, but by providing ongoing support through required teacher workshops. On the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, teachers are not just encouraged, they are required to come to workshops that focus on the content of the course, the pedagogy, and the assessment. So the minimum number of days that any teacher would be on campus at one of these workshops is 3 days a year, and most of our teachers are probably there 5 or 6 days. They're broken up during the year. I want to highlight some of the sort of the pluses and the minuses, or the advantages and the benefits of particularly concurrent enrollment, because I think that is the least understood option for students. So I would want to point out that the concurrent enrollment college in the schools benefits not just the students, but the teachers. So at Twin Cities campus, for the same price, for just one price, a high school gets not only the opportunity for their students to earn University of Minnesota credit, but they also get ongoing professional development. I'll just say right now that this year our charge for a college in the schools on the Twin Cities campus is $141 per student per course, not per credit, but per course. That is the only money that program gets to run on. So we walk a tightrope. We have to charge enough to run a quality program, and we have to charge a small enough number that high schools can afford it. If you are aware of discussions about professional development, you will know that having ongoing professional development work with the same group of teachers focused on a course is the gold standard of professional development. These teachers are required to come for as long as they teach for the University of Minnesota. So we've had teachers who've been coming for 10 years. They develop a depth of knowledge that is marvelous.
Ms. Henderson?
Yes.
$141 per course?
Per student.
Per student. And give us the comparison if it was a PSEO 3-credit course.
The PSEO has a completely different formula. The high schools will, in a sense, they lose. They never see the money. They lose a significant portion of their per student money that they are allocated by the state. I think the Department of Ed would be best positioned to answer that, or Danielle. It's what, 100 and, per credit charge?
It's 177.68
per credit is taken at the university. Yeah. It's complex, but I can tell you that one of the factors that has driven the increase in concurrent enrollment is that the schools lose less money with concurrent enrollment than they do with the PSEO on-campus option.
Is it fair to say it's 67% more cost-effective?
I will refrain from giving a percentage, but I will tell you it is it costs less money. It costs a lot less money to the high schools.
Plus staff development.
And they get staff development. So the concurrent enrollment model offers the best option for staff development. And the staff development, I want to tell you that, again, that's handled differently from college to college, but on the Twin Cities campus, we have a University of Minnesota faculty or staff person that meets with these teachers and who has taught the course, who knows the course. They stay with those people. They're available by email. They're available by phone. Our faculty go out and visit. So, which leads me to the next, if I just wanted to highlight some of the benefits that concurrent enrollment has that you might not know about, is that it really develops that college and high school relationship. We all know that articulation and expectations about what high school students are supposed to be able to do and what they should know in order to succeed in college, that's been an issue of discussion and concern for decades. With these teachers, they get a firsthand glimpse, and often for the first time, they know what the history department at the university wants, or what the comp what the comp courses ask. And it's not just that college in the schools teacher who learns that then. That teacher goes right back to their high school, to their department, and says, okay, this is what our students need to be ready to do. So they look down, they go down the line to ninth grade, and they can prepare the student. They will change the curriculum that they are teaching in order to prepare students to be ready for and succeed in the university course. So it's a great boon to addressing that articulation question. For both PSEO and CIS, this is another strong point, and I am, I am openly an advocate for these programs, so you'll have to take that into consideration. The dollars for PSEO and CIS stay in Minnesota. They don't go to the college board in New Jersey or wherever they are. So,
New York.
Okay, so back east there. So that's, that's something to, to think about. We hear from our teachers and principals. In fact, we did a survey of principals about 4 years ago and asked them, why aren't you adding more college in the schools courses to your curriculum? The number one reason, the overwhelming reason, was dollars. Everything comes down to dollars. We are thrilled with the reimbursement to the high schools that the legislature passed last year. We're thrilled with that. We are also hoping passionately that over time that will increase, because I want you to know that high schools are not getting $150 per student or student registration. The latest that I've heard is they're going to get more like $40. So it's because the demand is so far exceeds the supply of money. So
I have to ask you to wrap up, just okay. Deference to the others.
This will be my last thing. I would urge you to talk with principals and teachers and students to understand these options. All of them have good things to offer, but they also have significant differences. And so I think to hear from all the stakeholders of how that impacts them, what effect it's had on their academic career, would be extremely useful. And one last thing. The credits transfer everywhere, not just in Minnesota, but coast to coast. So thank you so much for asking about these issues, and I'll be happy to supply more information.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Lopez, Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and with me I have Linda Lottie, the Director of College Transitions for the system, to answer any technical questions that might come up that I can't handle. Minnesota State Colleges and Universities are very, very supportive of the post-secondary enrollment options program. We think that it's a wonderful opportunity for students to have accelerated learning options in a variety of different ways. And in fact, our colleges and universities have been very creative in finding new and innovative ways to provide these opportunities for students. During the most recent fiscal year, we enrolled over 20,000 high school students in PSEO courses, including concurrent enrollment courses, that is, PSEO either at the college and university campuses or in the high schools. Of that total, about 5,500 were on the campuses, and about 15,000 were offered in the high schools. We have done some research on outcomes for these students, and we are doing quite a bit more that we will be able to report in the future. But generally, we know that PSEO students enroll in college and university at higher rates than other students. They have lower rates of participation in remedial or developmental courses, and they complete degrees at higher rates than other students. I think these are all benefits not only to the students but also to the state. And so there is, I think, a dollar benefit to the state from these opportunities. As I said, a number of our colleges and universities have developed innovative ways providing these courses. I'd like to just briefly mention some of those. Of course, online, I think, is one of the best things that we have going right now. As you've heard from several of the previous presenters, it's difficult sometimes for rural schools, small schools, to offer AP courses. It's often difficult to find a critical mass of students to provide a particular curriculum option. But if we have an institution that's able to deliver online courses, then you really don't need 20 or 30 students. You can have one student at a computer making a connection with a college or university instructor at the campus. And in fact, Lake Superior College, which was mentioned earlier, it has a very, very creative program called the College Honors Online Program. Require students to have a 3.0 GPA and the recommendation of the college, of the high school principal or counselor. Give you an indication of the numbers and the school districts that are being aided by this program. In fall of 2008, Carleton High School, for example, was able to participate, to have seven students participate. Cook County, Grand Marais, four. Cromwell Wright, six. Willow River, one. You know, it would have been impossible for that opportunity to be provided at the high school for these students, but through the online program, we're doing it, and I think in a very, very cost-effective way. Rochester Community and Technical College has established what I think is just a wonderful partnership with the Rochester Public Schools, and what they're doing is through a contract, students from the Rochester Public Schools are taking PSEO courses at the Rochester Community and Technical College campus, but it's not a situation where they're being lost to the school district because the courses are being provided through a contract. So the Rochester Public Schools retains the funding. The district pays the college for these courses. There are some savings to the school district, but what they've developed then is a partnership to use those savings for the benefit of the students and, in fact, to help additional students make the transition into college. And one use of the program has been a bridge program. During the summer, graduates of Rochester Public Schools who were not PSEO students, they are given the college readiness testing, and if they're required to take developmental courses, they're offered the opportunity to take these courses during the summer. The tuition is paid for them by the school district, and they are then able to transition, get themselves ready to take regular college courses during the summer. It's been a very, very effective program, something that Rochester likes, obviously the community college likes, because then come fall, the students are ready to take their regular college classes. It's my understanding that the school district is now going to take some of that money and provide scholarships for students from Rochester Public Schools to go on to college. So it's really a win-win situation for everybody. We believe that, as you've heard earlier, there are a lot of advantages and benefits to PSEO beyond the value of earning college credits. And I think it's important to realize that a PSEO on-campus opportunity is certainly not something that everyone is ready for. Not every 15 or 16-year-old is ready for the college environment. Some of them, though, have the cognitive ability to handle those courses. So maybe a concurrent enrollment experience still on the high school campus is something that benefits them and that they would be better served by. On the other hand, for some students, the college environment really is the place that they should go. On a positive note, Mr. Chair, I'd like to say that I have experienced the PSEO or the benefits of the PSEO program because three of my own children have taken PSEO courses. My older daughter took PSEO courses from two private colleges. Two of my other children took, in fact, quite a few credits of PSEO courses from Century College. All of them said that it was a wonderful experience and really prepared them for going on to four-year colleges and universities. So be happy to answer any questions that you have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, thank you. As the committee traveled during the interim, we visited many districts and often heard comments on the PSEO program. And I'd be interested to know, you gave some very good examples of the opportunities that this can present for students. I was somewhat concerned, frankly, at some of the comments that were made across the state at various districts. And I'm interested in if you have data that suggests that students are, in fact, taking college preparatory academic courses versus maybe some courses that maybe aren't considered to be quite as focused, maybe in the areas of science and math and English.
And if I might add, I think the testimony from principals and others was, you know, is it rigorous to reimburse for yoga, guitar, and courses while they're in high school? And if we recall the testimony that we had at a recent hearing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I can certainly understand the perception that one might have that this is not a rigorous course. On the other hand, they are courses that do apply toward graduation. And in fact, at most of our community colleges, a physical education credit, in many cases, two physical education credits are required for graduation. So those courses do meet the test of applying toward a post-secondary degree.
Further questions? Or yes, please.
That's your major.
Ms. Lottie?
Chair Wieger and members of the committee, also I would like to just emphasize that when a student under the PSEO program takes these courses, that those courses need to be approved by several different parties, the parents, the high school, and the college. So they are checked over, and the student, of course. So they are checked to see if those courses actually apply to requirements that student needs, first and foremost, to graduate from high school to stay on track, and then secondly, to meet some type of requirement for whatever college program they are involved with. So there's a checks and balances involved in that.
Okay. Thank you very much to the testifiers. Senator Roebling, we'll take one more question, then we'll go to item four.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, since most of the instructors for college in the schools in particular have to have a lot of experience, and a lot of them, I think that they said that they needed a master's plus or a bachelor's degree plus 16 credits in that topic area. Do they, and they are going to extra training, do they get compensated differently? Do the instructors get compensated? So besides the school paying the university for coordinating the program, does the university provide any money back to the instructor for doing these types of courses in the school. I mean, they're regular high school teachers otherwise, and they're probably pretty high on the pay scale if they have those kinds of years of experience and credits. So how does that work for the faculty?
Ms. Lotte. Senator Roebling, there is no extra compensation to the high school instructor that teach those courses. Basically, we're simply requiring them to have the same or equivalent credentials to a college instructor who would be providing that coursework.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and we do need to move ahead, but we will be revisiting this. Next, Ms. Belfry.
Hello.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Debbie Belfry. I work as the Career Development Director for Bloomington Public Schools, and I also represent the West Suburban Hennepin County districts, the 13 districts, as their Perkins and Tech Prep Coordinator. It's wonderful to be here today. It is Career and Technical Education Month, as proclaimed by the Governor of Minnesota and the U.S. Congress, and so it's a wonderful opportunity to speak to career and technical education today. You have two handouts that I've provided. I found out that we duplicated some efforts from the Department of Education, so you already have the My Choices piece. I have also provided this handout that identifies Minnesota career fields, clusters, and pathways as produced by the Department of Education and the Minnesota State Colleges and University System, and a brochure describing career and technical education for you. Career and technical education, as I've listened to each representative talk about their program areas, has been around for more than 80 years by law and in definition in education. As you can see on the brochure, we serve 163,000 unduplicated count students in the state of Minnesota. So over 90% of our students in the state of Minnesota take at least one career and technical education course. Career and technical education courses include agriculture and food science, business marketing, family and consumer sciences and service occupations, health occupations, technology, trade, and industry, and work-based learning and work experience. On the back side of the brochure, you'll also notice that if you look at employment and the outlook on jobs in Minnesota, career and technical education covers just about every job on that list. And our students are being prepared to meet the needs of those industries in Minnesota also. The change over the years from our thinking of, as Assistant Commissioner Klinzing pointed out, from our thinking of vocational education to what we do today is the rigor that's been added to all of these program areas. In agriculture and food science, we know that that's an area now of biotechnology, biobusiness, and inclusion of many of the biosciences. Business and marketing education is providing the financial literacy for our students in business and marketing areas and the need of managers coming forward. Family consumer sciences, early childhood development, child development, food science, hospitality industry, which is, we know, very important to the state of Minnesota and included one of the service industries and occupations. Our healthcare almost needs no explanation in how we provide education for our secondary students to earn certifications and then to move into post-secondary education by having those certifications with them as they leave high school to transition into the college programs in health sciences. Technology education has dramatically changed because of the number of computers in an engine of a car. We, as many of you know, the Project Lead the Way initiative, which is a nonprofit pre-engineering initiative in the state, in the nation, is implemented in many of our school districts and now also in our community college system. In Bloomington schools, we offer Project Lead the Way pre-engineering programming for our middle school students because we know the critical need to create that pipeline. in our high schools, and Normandale Community College also is now offering Project Lead the Way courses in biotechnology and computer integrated manufacturing. In conjunction and collaboration with what we've heard today, computer integrated manufacturing is a course that requires an extensive amount of equipment that secondary schools cannot possibly imagine that they could have in their buildings. And so what we are doing is working with Normandale and Bloomington schools and then other schools to look at how we can collaborate through all of the options that you've listened to. Those students can earn college credit as they sit in high school Project Lead the Way courses. We are looking at how we can do concurrent enrollment or dual enrollment to have our students be able to access those courses in computer integrated manufacturing at Normandale Community College. And so that work is started, and it's wonderful to hear of the opportunities that everybody's talking about for our high school students to be able to transition with college credits, certifications, and those college opportunities in high school so that they more easily move on to college level courses. We also have found through the engagement of application, of course, we keep our students more engaged, and there are many studies to show that it keeps students from dropping out when they can become engaged in the application of these different program areas. Biomedical fields, obviously, are becoming more and more important, and as we look at career and technical education program areas, and the rigor that we have included and started to develop over the past decade, what this also has done is highlight the need for STEM education. We hear about STEM education a lot, but what does STEM education really mean? A reminder that the acronym stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. And career and technical education oftentimes provides the technology and engineering. Engineering being defined as how do we apply our science and math skills to the application to help to solve problems. And so oftentimes we hear a lot about the science integration and math integration, and we forget where the technology and the engineering come into that acronym. And career and technical education provides many, many of those opportunities to actually do the application. So we are looking very carefully at all the integration of science and math in our technology education courses, in our career and technology education courses. It's wonderful to listen to everybody prior to me speak, because oftentimes when they gave you examples, Assistant Commissioner Klinzing talked about the strongest bridges being through articulated credits with the colleges, which we've been doing for decades. But it's everybody's becoming more aware of it and the need to have our students be successful both in secondary education and post-secondary education to take advantage of those opportunities. Assistant Commissioner Klinzing also mentioned the CLEP testing and used business as an example. We've heard a lot of examples of medical careers, medical technologies, and the vast range of the medical preparation that we can offer students. Not only for medical technicians, but then for doctors and nurses, and we know all of the occupations in between the beginning steps of entering a medical occupation and service area and the wide range of the education needed for all of those jobs. We've heard programs of study talked about and the collaboration now between secondary schools and post-secondary institutions, and those programs of study, which are defined here, and again, Assistant Commissioner Klinzing referred to those, but this gives you a visual of what those are. As a matter of fact, next week, and there were some questions about how are we collaborating our programs of study, there's an all-day conference, and there is a uniform template that the state of Minnesota, all regions, will be using to define their programs of study, and that will be in a unified data system so that all of our information from all of our programs of study, secondary to post-secondary transitions, are defined in the same way, so they're easy to read, and that will be occurring next week from all the regions across the state. The secondary and post-secondary partners will be attending those together because, as Assistant Commissioner Klinzing mentioned, we do need to meet requirements of career education, rigorous coursework in secondary schools, transitioning to at least 2 years in post-secondary education. So that work is progressing. I've heard a lot of discussion about articulated credit. It's important to know, and the principal of Pine City brought this up. There are more and more regional agreements and discussions going on with articulated credits, so our students can easily use those articulated credits, not just at the community college or technical college or state college down the road, but universally around the state of Minnesota. Those discussions have been going on for years. It's important to get all of the participants in the room together to make sure that we're in agreement on how those articulated credits are used. But again, as you've heard over and over again today, those articulated credits, the dual enrollment, the concurrent enrollment, PSEO options, AP options are vitally important for all of our student learners to transition from secondary to post-secondary education. So I just want to emphasize to you and call out what program areas in career and technical education are. We have been changing our thinking for a long time to transfer our thought process from vocational education areas or those classes that are at the backside of the high school. Those classes now have many, many opportunities and are in the central part of the schools with the integration of their science and math departments. Some of you saw that in taking place in Osseo and their medical and health sciences programs. And so you can see the difference compared to what sometimes we think of, unless we've been in those high schools currently, to see those program areas. So it has changed because of the rigor, because of the need for our students to be engaged and for our students to move on to post-secondary education. And that's part of our job in secondary education, to help them understand what those opportunities are as they move forward.
Thank you very much for the overview. Questions? And because of the hour, I'm going to ask if you might submit after any policy recommendations that you might have as well, and if you could submit them to us for distribution.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
And finally, we have the South St. Paul presentation. And thank you for your patience, and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting us to be here. We are so excited to talk to you about our diploma program. We are from South St. Paul Public Schools. We have an enrollment of approximately 3,200 kids. We have all day,
please state your name for the record.
Patty Hemanover, superintendent at South St. Paul. We have all day, every day kindergarten, and we have over 565 kids that are open enrolled to our district. A lot of those kids are coming because of our IB program, the diploma program. We provided for you some materials. There is a packet of our IB. It also has information on our PYP and MYP. We are one of the schools. We will probably be the first school in the nation to be a K-12 IB school. We have information on the MYP and the PYP and, of course, the diploma program. We were also featured in Education Week in October 31st because of our programs, and we're very pleased about the information that we've been able to provide to other school districts and to help them to make their programs even better.
Superintendent, wasn't there just an article in the St. Paul paper, too, about your program?
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that. Congratulations.
We have been getting a lot of press on it, so we are pleased. Not to take much time, I would like to present Conrad Anderson. He is our IB coordinator and also teacher. He has a short presentation for you today.
Okay. Welcome, Conrad.
Mr. Chair, my name is Conrad Anderson. I am the IB coordinator at South St. Paul High School. I'm also an IB history teacher, so I have the luxury of working with seniors that have gone through this program, and I can attest to the type of students that we're turning out at South St. Paul High School. Just a quick history. In 1968, the IB organization was started to help international schools, mainly for British and American students that were with parents that were living abroad, have a common common curriculum so that when they were mobile, they could go to international school and provide a common curriculum. In about the early to mid-80s, school districts started to realize that this is a very rigorous, challenging program. And we happened to have a superintendent, Dr. David Metzen, at the time, who had the vision to bring this program to South St. Paul High School. And we were the first metro school, second.
That was Metzen?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Metzen. Exactly. And we were the second school in the state, first metro school to offer international baccalaureate starting in 1986. One thing you'll notice, that, and hopefully I'll show you how unique this program is that it really does focus on developing the whole student. It's not just a course or a test that you take to get college credit, although that is the case. You can do that. But it is much more into developing the whole student. You've been provided these slides as well, so you can follow along. This is quickly the IBO's goal, is to provide students with the values and opportunities that will enable them to develop sound judgment, make wise choices, and respect others in the global community. And I will be bringing us back to that piece, that international piece, because of kind of where we are in the global economy now, that a program like this is essential, I believe. Superintendent Hemnover had mentioned, we are a K-12 IB district, and there's a primary years program that actually starts before kindergarten, takes our students through sixth grade. Then there's a 7-10 middle years program, and then it culminates in the 11th and 12th grade diploma program. All three programs strive to create what we have is the learner profile, and that all of our students would have these characteristics or qualities. They would be inquirers, they'd be knowledgeable, they'd be thinkers, communicators, principled, open-minded, caring, risk-takers, balanced, and reflective students. What is the IB Diploma Program? Assistant Commissioner Klingsley already mentioned some of this, but it is a two-year program for the last 2 years of their high school. Internationally, it's for ages 16 to 19, but for United States and Minnesota schools, it would be for grades 11 and 12. If you complete the whole program, you would receive a qualification in the form of an IB diploma in addition to your state diploma that is recognized by world's leading universities. Like I mentioned before, it's developed to develop the whole student. Students learn more than a collection of facts. The diploma program prepares students for university and college and encourages them to do these things, to ask challenging questions, to learn how to learn. When I conclude today, I'll explain why that learning how to learn is such an important piece. Develop a strong sense of their own identity and culture, and develop the ability to communicate with and understand people from other countries and cultures. 2IB, the well-rounded student, actually isn't round at all. It's a hexagon. And if you look at the shape up here, a student that gets the IB diploma will actually have to test in six different areas. Group one is their language A1. That's the mother tongue language. Obviously, for most of our students, it's English. Group two, they have to become fluent in a second language. Group three, individuals and societies, your typical social studies offerings. Group four is experimental sciences. And group five, math and computer science. And then group six is the arts. You'll also notice in the center of the hexagon, there are three things that I'll get to a little bit later called the extended essay, theory of knowledge, and the piece called creativity, action, and service. Just to show you what this looks like at South St. Paul High School, you can see that all of our students that are full diploma students would take, and I'll talk about what HL and SL means in a little bit, but they would take English for their group one subject. They can choose between Spanish, French, and Russian for their group two language B. They can choose between history and psychology for group three, chemistry and biology for group four. And then we have three tracks of math, ranging from math studies, which is a humanities-minded math, to calculus 2, which is higher-level math. And then we also offer a visual arts course. What IB does understand is not all students are art students, however, and so they do allow you to not take a group 6 and to double up in one of the other groups to get the diploma. Those SL and HL stand for standard level and higher level. To get the diploma, you'll need at least three higher level subjects, and then fill in for the other to make up the six subjects, fill in the rest for standard level subjects. You cannot take more than four higher level subjects. Higher level subjects are that require 240 hours of seat time, instructional time with the classroom. Thus, it takes 2 years to complete those exams that are taken in your senior year. Standard level courses could be completed by the junior year, and those require at least 150 hours of instructional time. Plus, a student would have to complete those central core requirements. Those core requirements are really important to developing the whole student. Between the junior and senior year, students have to choose one area that they're passionate about to complete what's called an extended essay. That's a 4,000-word essay in which they really have to show that they have developed research and writing skills. They could choose any subject they want, English, history. If they're into science, they could do biology experiments and do lab reports. But it is quite an undertaking. It has to be on their own time. So that they tend to do it during the summer of between their junior and senior year, and they get one-on-one guidance with an advisor at our school. The Theory of Knowledge course is a class that all diploma candidates have to take. It is the course that binds all the other subjects together. It is a course designed to provide coherence by exploring the nature of knowledge to think about how we think, the metacognition, to learn how to learn, and to encourage and appreciate other cultural perspectives. I liken this where I'll teach my IB history students something, and they'll go to Theory of Knowledge, and they'll learn about different approaches to history. I work with the Theory of Knowledge instructor very closely so that and he works with all the subjects so that they kind of see different perspectives and different ways to interpret different course offerings. Also essential and a core requirement of the IB diploma program is this CAS program. It's called stands for Creativity, Action, and Service. They require all students that want to get the IB diploma to have 150 CAS hours, 50 of which have to be in the area of service, either giving back to their local community, to state, national, or international projects, as well as they just don't want you to be an academic student. They want you to develop the creative elements, such as joining debate or speech or working with the yearbook. But that has to be all things that happen outside of the class, as well as action. And if you're in sports, for example, those fulfill your action requirements.
Excuse me, Mr. Anderson, yes. This is an excellent presentation. We have 10 more minutes we can be in here. And so for allocating between you,
very good.
I will appreciate your understanding.
Yep. What's really unique about the IB program too is the test that they take their senior year, or junior or senior year. And it's not just one test that they take, or just even a couple tests. It's varied assessment. Worldwide, there are 4,000 examiners that work for the International Baccalaureate Organization. For example, I am an examiner for IB History. We have what's called both internal and external assessments. Internal assessments are evaluated by teachers in the school and then moderated by other examiners abroad. And so there's an internal piece, and that's usually like a project that they would do in the class that becomes part of their final score that they would get. There's transparency. They use criterion reference rubrics that provide consistency in grading. There are always multiple methods of assessment for each course. There's varied skills tested across the disciplines, and I'll give you some examples of that in a moment. There's a balance between independent and teacher-supervised work, and students maintain a control over many aspects of the assessment. I won't spend a lot of time here, but this shows you a little bit of the difference between internal and external tests. Internal tests usually are projects or assignments that the teacher will give. The student will complete those assignments. The teacher marks them. And what's really nice about this is then the teacher has to send scores to IB, and IB gives you a name of someone to send a sample of what you've scored so that they concur that they've been scored correctly. And so in a sense, it's someone else that's grading our teachers. External assessments are the tests that you're used, like an AP test or an IB test, but those are actually, those tests are packaged, they're sent abroad, someone scores them, The examiner then sends them on to a moderator, and then those moderator will mark those tests up or down if necessary as well. So you can see that there's many levels of scoring. And the reason why they have to do this is it's rarely is there ever a multiple choice test. It's all writing tests and essay tests that require it's more of an objective examination. Just a couple of quick examples here. For example, language A1, which is English, that score that they get, which will eventually be between a 1 and a 7, has all these components to it. There's an in-class oral presentation the student has to give that the teacher scores. There's a taped face-to-face oral examination or an oral commentary that they complete with the teacher. There are two world literature papers that are graded by someone other than the teacher at school. They're sent abroad to be scored. And there's two written examinations that they take in May. All of those scores then are combined together to get a score of 1 to 7 at the end.
Mr. Anderson, yes. I think that you can be less detailed and be a little broader so very that we good. Can hear from the other speakers
okay.
too, because
sure.
I don't think that's as useful for us.
Okay, very good. To get that IB diploma, they have to then complete all those core requirements to complete all those IB assessments, take 6 courses, 1 from each group, and then assessments are then scored on a 1 to 7 scale. And if you average 4 on those 6 assessments, then you can get the IB diploma. For a long time, there have been rumors about the differences between IB and AP. Oftentimes, IB was perceived as inferior to AP. IB is a disadvantage in the college admissions process. Those have been rumors that have been around there for a while, though I think they're dissipating now. One of the when I started 15 years ago, I know that that was the case for many colleges and universities. It's not anymore. Here are some of the realities. 850 colleges and universities across the nation and Canada actually have specific IB policies. That covers 95% of the students. Now colleges and universities consistently equate AP and IB. Study of 2001 IB graduates show IB substantially increases chance of admission. In 2004, this legislature passed the Get Ready, Get Credit bill that allows students if they get the diploma and they go to a Minsku school, they will get 30 semester hours, so basically sophomore standing by completing the diploma. And then the University of Minnesota, which has different standards because they're a land-grant college, does require that you get 5 or higher on all of your exams for a total of 30 points and 30 semester hours. This is from a book called Super Test on How the International Baccalaureate Can Strengthen Our Schools by Jay Matthews. And just a quick example of several high-level top schools around the nation, what their average acceptance rates are, and and students that have the IB diploma, what their acceptance rates are. And you can see there's quite a disparity there. And just to wrap up, we were talking about the pros and the cons. Benefits, clearly it develops the whole student. Teachers in the IB diploma program are trained. Everyone has to be trained, and they are helped with questions they have by trainers that help implement the curriculum. Training, as well as the IB Online Curriculum Center, provide excellent support and allows teachers to network around the world with other teachers sharing best practices. Other benefits, there's breadth, depth, and rigor of the curriculum that really are centered around critical thinking, reading, and writing skills. The international mindedness of the program prepares students for a changing world. And once schools are authorized, they're able to maintain the program. For example, South St. Paul was authorized in 1986. We've gone through OBE, Profiles of Learning, BSTs, MCAs, and our program has been able to be maintained. Challenges. It is quite extensive to implement.
We'll need to sum up now.
Okay. If you just look at the challenges, I think that there are it's quite extensive to implement this, and oftentimes it's very high cost to start up, but there has been a lot of state aid recently for covering student costs as far as for testing is concerned and teacher training. And if you've read The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman, all the things he talks about, especially in Chapter 7, and how our students need to be prepared, I think are embodied in our IB program those 4 points are made specifically in that Chapter 7, things like learning how to learn, developing the right side of the brain, learning how to interact and manage with other people. There's a couple more websites that you can get more information on as far as our school district's offerings, as well as a very comprehensive site on IBO.org.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson.
We're sold.
Sorry I had to go very fast.
Yes.
No, we're sold. We were sold about halfway through your presentation.
And Jane Stassen, a great article that we have in the packet, too, from Education Week, on which speaks for itself. But welcome to the committee. Thank you for your patience. And
thank you.
Please,
I have nothing.
Conclude
I will,
in the next few minutes.
Committee, I will defer any time to Conrad for questions. I just want to say thank you. We were one of the 6 recipients of one of the MDIB grants. Our goal is, as outlined by the Assistant Commissioner, is to increase the number of kids who are participating in all of our programming. You need to know that both the middle years and the primary years program are totally inclusive and include all kids who come into our buildings. There are multiple threads that run through all 3 of these programs, too numerous to mention at this time, and we're thrilled to have the opportunity to make this a reality in our community.
Okay, we have Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, do all students then start in primary school with a foreign language? And if you're not doing, like, multiple choice testing at the elementary level, I mean, do they still do things like spelling tests and the standard, things that they obviously they have to do our basic skills tests at some point.
Yes.
So how do you get them ready for that?
3 questions there that I heard. First of all, the requirement, all of the programs require a strong emphasis on language acquisition, not only our language of instruction, which is English, but also the introduction of a world language as early as age 7. Our kids, as early as kindergarten, are receiving, in our schools, our decision for world language is Spanish, and our kids are receiving Spanish instruction as early as kindergarten. The beauty of these programs is they are flexible enough to allow us to not only embed but also to embrace all the requirements from the state and federal government in terms of all the state academic standards. All of our standards are being addressed. Our kids will be adequately prepared to take the MCAs, 3 through 8 and 10 and 11. And the assessments, the focus is on common formative and summative assessments. So the types of assessments the list is extensive, anywhere from spelling tests to quizzes to traditional multiple choice. We had to, in fact, develop an assessment policy that lists the many different types of ways that we assess our kids for proficiency and mastery. So it's not exclusively it's very age appropriate and developmentally appropriate for the age of the students being served.
Thank you.
Senator Rummel, the final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, 2 parts. You mentioned that the primary and the middle school, all students are in the IB program. Is that true in the high school? And for those in the high school who do go through the IB program, what do you know about their success in getting into and finishing college?
You can answer. Just let me answer for the middle years and primary years programs. All kids participate to the degree which they are able. A student who might have an IEP that would require them to do some additional type of service or requirements that would certainly take precedent. But all kids participate in the program, K through 6 and 6 through 10.
Yep. And as far as the students going on to college, I've only been doing the coordinator job for 4 years, and I think we lack some data, but I do have contact with almost all of our students that go through the program, and they send me emails back all the time. I've yet to hear about a student that was in the IB program that did not complete college.
Thank you, the South St. Paul delegation, for your trailblazing efforts.
Thank you.
And members, thank you for allowing us to go a little bit beyond. And To all the testifiers and others, we appreciate your participation. We are impressed with the variety of dual choice options that are available for students, and there's a number of informational requests we've made that we'll use to further process potential policy recommendations in the future. And I'll yield to Senator Pappas for
Mr.
the final
Chairman,
word.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank you for organizing this meeting, and that I hope we can do more P16 cross-jurisdictional hearings in the future.
Thank you. The committee is adjourned.
That's really great. Thank you.
Very good.
I love this.
Yeah, thank you.
Excellent.
Hey, Claire, did you guys get something in the mail for Johnston's ring? Did you guys? And it has a class ring.